Major funding for the following edition of Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. The Sonnets of William Shakespeare, this week on Soundings. Join me now for a conversation with Helen Vendler of Harvard University.
The expensive spirit in a waste of shame is lust in action. And till action, lust is perjured, murderous, bloody, full of blame, savage. The poet is always there, arranging what the persona says. That is to say, often the persona is represented as having a moment of naivete, having a moment of self-deception. But the
Helen Vendler is a professor of English at Harvard University. She also serves as poetry critic for The New Yorker. During a recent visit to the National Humanities Center, Helen Vendler discussed the Sonnets of William Shakespeare. Helen Vendler, welcome back to Soundings. Let's talk about Shakespeare and Shakespeare's sonnets. You're interested in lyric poetry. To the exclusion of the novel, drama? Tell me about this interest of yours.
Well, I think critics in general are interested in one genre more than another, just as writers are. Perhaps we're the poet's manqué or the novelist's manqué, but generally you find people writing about plays or writing about novels. Not too many people write about many genres at once. Some critics do, and they may be like the writers who write novels and poems. But on the whole, if you think of someone like James Joyce, for instance, who had all the words in English to his command and certainly was full of imaginative ideas, nonetheless, his poems are very disappointing things. It's as though he had one capacity of expression but not the other, and I think critics are like that, perhaps, and I don't feel as though I understand the novel or the play in the same way that I understand poetry.
Are you giving Shakespeare his due poetically? I mean, by concentrating, by looking at the sonnets, since so many people write about the dramas. You've said that every word, every line in the plays has its own book, its own library.
It's true that most people who have become Shakespeareans have been drawn to him by the drama, and they are people interested in the drama, and they see him primarily as a dramatist, and if they turn their attention to the sonnets, they tried to make the sonnets into a little proto-drama, as though the sonnets were Othello or The Winter's Tale, and that's really not the way to go at it, I think.
Well, how do you come to them? Your original project was a book of, how many are there, 154?
Yes.
What about that?
Well, I wanted to write on all of them because most of the books talk about the 18 or 20 most famous ones, and there are wonderful poems among the sonnets that have never really been commented on much at all as poems. They might be taken up as examples of friendship or love or remarks on time and death, but not poetry. So I really decided to write a commentary and write an essay on each one of the 154 poems. That's what I'm doing.
All right. Now, I asked you before our taping session, Helen Vendler, if all of lyric poetry is a footnote to Shakespeare, and you said no to Milton. But let's move to Shakespeare. Why is he important to our understanding today of lyric poetry? Why is lyric poetry, by extension, relatively neglected in these times?
Well, you would have to ask which countries it was relatively neglected in.
Okay.
That is, many countries have a long history of poetry written by their own authors, and poetry that derives from poems written on the same soil. If you think of Italian poetry, it goes back to Dante, it derives from Latin poetry, and so on. So there's a kind of patriotic interest in preserving Dante as part of the American, part of the Italian cultural heritage. We have a much shorter literary history in this country, and it's not generally felt that the literature of other countries and of the past is so relevant to American experience. I think it is. As Eliot said about the authors, that we are wiser than they are, we know more than they are do because they are what we know. And so America knows a lot about the cultural past, but rather conveniently forgets it, I think in part because the immigrant experience meant putting the cultural past behind you. And since we are a nation of immigrants, we wanted to get rid of Europe rather than preserve Europe, so to speak.
Haven't you observed that that the teaching of poetry really is a sort of a long dead issue in American schools? That's awfully unfortunate.
It is unfortunate, and on all things considered, it said that the proportion of poetry in school texts had gone down in something like 15 or 20 years from something like 30% to something like 3%. And that sense of its being phased out comes from its not being a very natural part of a child's youthful culture in America. Children used to encounter a lot of poetry, for instance, through singing hymns in church, mm-hmm. and perhaps in local village song singing and so forth in the 19th century. But now there's not much singing, for instance, that goes on, which is the rudimentary form of poetry.
Uh-huh. Why did you memorize Shakespeare's sonnets? You did this, you said, from the time you were 12 or 13 years old? Memorize them all?
Well, I used to learn... I didn't memorize them all then. I memorized maybe 30 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted to be able to carry them around with me, I guess. And that's the main reason for memorizing a poem, is that you don't have to have a book to remind you of it.
Uh-huh.
But also my mother knew many, many poems by heart, among them Shakespeare's sonnets. And so I think because she knew them and used to quote them, I probably thought it natural to learn them.
Uh-huh. If I know a lot about this man's life, and as I understand it, there's not a lot to know, does that mean that I understand the sonnets any better?
It depends. There are some people whose poetry springs very intimately out of their lives. You can think of, for instance, Pound, who puts in whole anecdotes about his relations with Yeats or whatever uh-huh. in his poetry. And it helps to enrich the poem if you know, in that sense, the topical background and what was Yeats to Pound and what was Pound to Yeats. On the other hand, Pound's epic is just that, an epic of which the matter is history, you might say, whereas lyric poetry tends to dehistoricize and detopicalize itself. Lyric poetry asks the reader to step into the role. It's like a leader singer being asked to sing a lead and to be the person singing the song. Mm-hmm. So since it's a genre in which other people have to be able to step in and say it as if it were their own speech, you have to remove a lot of the topicalizing stuff so that almost anyone can walk into it.
How do we calculate lyric poetry moving across generations? I mean, how does it transcend from one culture to another?
Well, I don't think any art easily does that. That is to say, it would be very hard for me to respond adequately to the music of Chinese opera or perhaps to Indian music because I haven't been trained in those musical systems. So that depending on how much of the culture is already shared, there's a certain ability to cross cultures. But if the culture is not shared, as we don't share, say, the music of Chinese opera, there's no way that, and without a long training, that we can appreciate
it. Well, now, wait. I mean, we share very little with Elizabethan England. Am I not right about that?
Share a language.
Uh-huh. Well, all right. So I'm tempted to say, so what? But beyond that, like the Peggy Lee song, is that all there is? Is that all that's necessary?
No, we share many cultural attitudes about romantic love, about fidelity, our constancy as values, about the transiency of life, mortality, the unintelligibility of culture in the long run. I mean, all of these things turn up in Shakespeare's sonnet. So thematically, I think sexual jealousy and so forth, there is a good deal of stuff. But I don't think poetry is written to be heard by anyone, or in fact to be overheard, as both John Stuart Mill and Eliot said. That puts the reader in the position of an eavesdropper on somebody bearing his heart.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's what it's meant to be at all. When you pick up the Ode to a Nightingale and you say, "My heart aches," you're not supposed to think that you're listening to Keats saying, "My heart aches." You're supposed to be saying, "My heart aches." It becomes your voice.
All right, well, now let's talk about voices in Shakespeare's sonnets. Who is the poet and who is the poetic persona?
The poet is always there arranging what the persona says. That is to say, often the persona is represented as having a moment of naivete, mm-hmm. having a moment of self-deception, but the author is the person who is arranging that the persona should look naive.
The author is the versifier.
That's right.
Okay.
The author is the person who arranges the rhymes, but also arranges the psychological picture of the speaker.
Mm-hmm. Whose mind are we trying to get into, if in fact we are, when we're trying to understand a poem? Is it the flesh and blood creator of this, the poet himself, herself, or the persona?
First of all, the persona, because then you can say what kind of speaker has been invented, what kind of situation the speaker has been put into, and you speak that speech of the persona as though it were your own speech, saying, mm-hmm. how would I be feeling if I were saying this? So there's a psychological rapprochement first, but then you think, what kind of an author would I be to want to portray this sort of persona, mm-hmm. and what sort of poet would I be that wanted to use this form or that kind of mm-hmm. thing?
All right, now Shakespeare is, in the popular phrase, a doom, is that it? A dead European white male. He's been accused of being a sexist and politically incorrect. What about charges like that? When we say, oh, Shakespeare is a sexist because he does X, Y, or Z, or represents women being subjected to this or that in the poetry or in the plays?
Well, those are complicated questions. But first of all, to use an anachronistic word like sexist, or to say, is Shakespeare sexist, to pose the question in that way, is like saying, was Shakespeare a Republican? That is to say, that didn't exist as a category into which he could have conceivably put himself.
But it exists for us. Therefore, isn't it compelling? Doesn't it make sense to us to ask that question?
Well, only if you think that cultural attitudes are easily translatable from one epic quite a long time ago to another.
And you think that they are not, generally speaking.
It's likely that one is translating them wrongly if one reads current cultural attitudes back too easily into the attitudes of 400 years ago,
uh-huh.
as in terms of what available attitudes there were then.
Well, is it fair to ask you why we're asking these questions today? Are we putting an undue pressure on Shakespeare, or indeed on ourselves, by asking such questions? Was he a sexist? That kind of thing.
I think it's a variety of moral question that keeps getting asked by people about literature. Literature causes a lot of moral anxieties in people, and the way it used to be put was to be asked whether this literature were obscene,
uh-huh.
or whether this literature were politically offensive earlier, whether it ought to be censored, if it's offensive to the state, or if it's seditious. At different epochs, those moral anxieties take different forms. Right now, instead of asking whether it's offensive to the state, people are asking whether it's offensive to women, or to blacks, or to homosexuals. But it's another way of treating literature as a form of moral instruction and then getting anxious about the instruction it's giving. If you don't think of literature as a form of moral instruction, then you don't have those anxieties.
Well, how do you bring the teaching of lyric poetry, the enterprise of lyric poetry, to your classes, your undergraduates at Harvard? If you're not moralizing with them, what, in fact, are you doing?
Well, Lowell said in his last poem, Robert Lowell, in the poem Epilogue, said in a moment of discouragement, what am I doing? And he wondered what grace the author should pray for. And he says, pray for the grace of accuracy. And then compares it to the accuracy that Vermeer gave to the sunlight stealing across a wall in a Vermeer painting. That capacity to paint infinite gradations of light as it goes across a cream-colored wall that you see in the light coming from a casement in a Vermeer painting onto a map or onto a wall.
Mm-hmm.
To paint every gradation of light as it gradually fades coming away from the casement window is the grace of accuracy to even the most minute facts of existence, and that is what any writer attempting to represent consciousness and anxieties of his time is doing.
Are we back to, is it Mr. MacLeish's formulation that poems shouldn't mean but be, and we just let it go at that?
Well, of course, that has been parodied many times. But that was an expression of a particular cultural anxiety against the Victorian moralizing.
Uh-huh.
A poem should be palpable and mute. And that sense that a poem was an object is a rather objectivist and imagistic notion of the poem.
Mm-hmm.
And an object is part of what a poem is, but to quote Lowell again, he said, a poem is not an event, a poem is an event, not a record of an event. And if you think of a poem as an event rather than an object, you will have a slightly different take on it, I think.
All right. How do you use Helen Vendler, Shakespeare's sonnets in your function as a reviewer of poetry? You write for The New Yorker, you write cultural criticism. Is he there in the back of your mind as a preoccupation, as an influence? What function does he serve?
I think all the poets serve the same function. They've given you a certain standard of satisfaction, you might say. And I've thought a lot about this with respect to Shakespeare. When you meet a poem that you are not particularly taken with, it generally seems to you rather thin or shallow. And I've noticed how often in Shakespeare there are several overlapping structures. There might be one structure of imagery that might divide the sonnet up into 8 and 6. Another overlapping structure of, say, pronouns might divide the first 4 lines about saying I, the next 8 lines saying you, and the last couple of lines saying we. Uh-huh. And overlapping on both those structures, there might be a grammatical or another grammatical or syntactic structure. Then there might be a conceptual structure. So if you read the 14 lines one way, you could read it 8-6, another way 4-4-4-2, another way 6-6-2, another way 2-10-2. And the sense of many interplaying structures is very like what you find in polyphonic music, where you have one thing going on one melodic line and another melody going on another line, or a fugue where things chase each other and different melodies are interpenetrating. Right. And that sense of complexity that's possible in language is, in a way, what you then expect of other poems. And when they only have one structure, you sort of are disappointed.
Right. This is, you're getting back to what you call reading for difference rather mm-hmm. than reading for similarity.
Well, when we read an essay, we try to put all the points together to make an intelligible point, and we see all the sub-points as somehow illustrating the main point, mm-hmm. and we see a topic sentence backed up with evidence.
Right.
That's the way we're taught to read, but poems are not constructed that way. They're not essays. They don't have topic sentences followed up by supporting evidence.
Oh, no, wait. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? That's a wonderful topic sentence.
It is, but many things happen to that before it ends.
Uh-huh.
That is, as you go through almost any poem worth its name, the poem evolves as it goes. It doesn't keep reiterating itself. It finds new ways to exfoliate. Hmm. And these are not simply repetitive and probative statements, but they are new, you might say, impulses of the mind, the way a song might go into the minor mode after having been in the major mode.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just a repetition of the first theme, but it's a repetition with a difference or an entirely new theme introduced in the middle.
This is Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You're listening to a conversation with Helen Vendler of Harvard University. Helen Vendler also serves as poetry critic for The New Yorker. During a recent visit to the National Humanities Center, she discussed the sonnets of William Shakespeare. Helen, read one of Shakespeare's sonnets for me. Which one have you picked?
I'm reading his sonnet on lust, number 129 in the group, and this is a famous poem, and on a theme that's much treated in literature. The expensive spirit in a waste of shame is lust inaction, and till action lust is perjured, murderous, bloody, full of blame, savage, extreme, rude, cruel, not to trust. Enjoyed no sooner, but despised straight, past reason hunted, and no sooner had past reason hated, as a swallowed bait on purpose laid to make the taker mad, mad in pursuit and in possession so, had, having, and in quest to have, extreme. A bliss in proof, and proved a very woe, before a joy proposed, behind a dream. All this the world well knows, yet none knows well to shun the heaven that leads men to this hell.
Helen Vendler, how does this poem exfoliate itself?
Well, I think you can see that at the beginning, it's got 4 nouns to start with, the expense of spirit in a waste of shame. And that's the first definition of lust that you have.
Mm-hmm. The possible topic sentence that we're going to take
yes.
apart.
But you notice as you get down lower in the poem, that lust is represented by several more nouns, bliss, woe, joy, dream. And they don't sound much at all as though they came from the same category as uh-huh. expense, spirit, waste, shame.
Right,
so something has happened.
Yeah, what's happened between?
Well, The first sense of lust that you have in this poem is the morning after sense, when you wake up and think, what have I done? And you name your actions by a kind of retrospective, judgmental, alienated way. Mm-hmm. Later on, after you've remembered all the way back to the beginning, you start remembering from the beginning forwards, and then you remember it as how it was when you were living it.
Mm-hmm. So this poem's about memory?
Yes.
What do you want to call them? Characters are doing the remembering here. Just one, I take it.
I think we are driven by the poem to postulate a single person recounting changes of attitude mm-hmm. towards a series of past actions. And one of the attitudes is a retrospective and judgmental and alienated attitude where you do say, what did I do? The expensive spirit and the waste of shame. Another attitude is remembering how it felt as you lived it. And that's a chronological memory. And that says it was a joy when it was proposed. It was a bliss when I was enjoying it. It was a woe afterwards. And perhaps now it all seems unreal, like a dream.
Does it look forward in any sense? Is there a future to this poem?
There isn't a future. There's only a sort of hellish cycle in which the cycle of desire, arousal, intercourse, repentance, disgust, blame, abstention, then begins all over again with arousal, intercourse, mm-hmm. enjoyment, etc. And that's the meaning of the third type of memory, which is the memory, the universal memory, all this the world well knows, yet none knows well to mm-hmm. shun. And the well knows well enacts that little circle, well knows well, well knows no well, and you're always uh-huh. going from heaven to hell, back and around. And so each of these three moments, the one where you repent, the one where you remember how beautiful it was when it was happening, and the one when you think, and I'm going to do it all over again, too,
All right. Are
these three moments of evolution of the poem, as I see it.
All right. Now, I was reared on a generation of literary criticism that was freighted heavily with the word irony. Mm-hmm. What's going on in this poem with respect? Is there an irony to all of that, or is it, after a fashion, moralizing again? You warned me about that a few minutes ago.
I think that each of the positions ironizes the other. That is to say, the alienated position is ironized by the emotional, chronological memory, and both of them ironize each other. The repentance ironizes remembrance ironizes repentance, and they're both ironized by the cyclic totalizing that goes yes, no, up, mm-hmm. down, and so forth.
Is irony the same thing as subversion, Helen Vendler? That is to say, when you walk into a class of, you know, young and tender minds, and you teach a poem like this, are you running risks by doing this stuff? That is to say, if you teach it, as you said a moment ago, with accuracy, mm-hmm. and the student reads it with accuracy, what function does it serve in those young minds that you are helping to form?
Well, most of us have rather primitive notions about human states of feeling, and most poems, because they're short, necessarily restrict themselves to a single now of the lyric poem. Most poems of this sort have either the shame moment, or they have the bliss moment, or they have the moment of saying, and I can't get out of this squirrel trap that I'm in. It's very rare that you have three moments in a single short poem like mm-hmm. this. And the essential message, if you want a moral message from such a poem, is don't forget today how you felt yesterday, and try to see the whole picture rather than be the person you are only at this moment.
Uh-huh. You've pointed out that one of your aims as a literary critic and as a teacher is to arrive at this moment of accuracy, as you've called it, paraphrasing, who was it? Lowell.
Lowell. Mm-hmm.
Is that the same thing as perfection? Does that mean that Shakespeare said it and said it forever when we talk about a deep and an abiding problem, lust in human behavior?
No, everyone sets it differently because everyone's imagination is differently formed. Shakespeare's imagination was formed by Petrarchism, by Christianity, by a monarchic system of authority. Keats's imagination is formed by a totally different set of deposits, including the poems of Shakespeare, which couldn't have formed Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. So that if you have the Keatsian imagination treating lust as he may be thought to do in something like Lamia, for instance, it's a totally different treatment. So, mm-hmm. And somebody contemporary would treat it differently.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Helen Vendler. You are a poetry, you teach poetry, you criticize poetry for The New Yorker. Tell me about the future of poetry. Is it healthy in the United States here in the 1990s?
One could wish it healthier in the sense that our young poets, many of whom are admirable, get it all starting in college on the whole, rather than getting it from first grade on. Mm-hmm. It's not impossible to start with college. It's not impossible to be a poet without going to school at all. Walt Whitman hardly went to school at all. Blake hardly went to school. Great talent will find its own way. But one wishes for the sake of those poets that they had found it sooner and had been brought up on it sooner, mm-hmm. just for their own, repertoire. The repertoire is what you've held for a long time and held dearly for a long time.
Mm-hmm. You refer, for example, to a reader's canon and then a writer's canon. That is to say, the stuff that the people who are producing the poetry are actually reading. That's what these young poets should be looking at?
Well, they all find their way. It's not as though they don't find poets to admire very much, but they tend to have read mostly modern poetry, so their repertoire isn't as well extended as one would want. I remember talking to one very well-known poet, and he was telling me about the new poems he was planning to write, and he said he wanted to write them on particular subjects with allegorical names, so that one would be called Justice, and another one would be called Vengeance, and another one would be called Mercy. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, that sounds like George Herbert. And he said, oh, really? And he was a man in his close to 40. I've never read George Herbert. I should look at him.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's why, I mean, the American poets tend to be in this predicament. It's not that he's not a good poet. He is. But somehow I feel sorry for him that mm-hmm. he had come to 40 without knowing about George Herbert and was reinventing the wheel in
some
way.
Well, that's what Emerson told us we do best. We live without a past.
That's
we live
right.
without history.
Mm-hmm. We do. And by the time we're 1,000 years old like Europe, we'll have as noble a literature as Europe does, and we will feel just as patriotic about it.
Helen Vendler teaches at Harvard University. She's also poetry critic for The New Yorker. During a recent visit to the National Humanities Center, Helen Vendler discussed the sonnets of William Shakespeare. The title of her remarks was Reading for Difference. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on the Sonnets of William Shakespeare is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 558. That's program number 558. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete summary of Soundings discussions available on cassette. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings. Next week, the concluding segment in a series of conversations entitled, What Should Teachers Know? Listen for Sarah Mazza of Northwestern University and Spencer Willard of Scotland High School in Laurinburg, North Carolina. Our topic will be the teaching of European and North American history in the nation's high schools and universities. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major support for this edition of Soundings came from the National Endowment for the Humanities. The Sonnets of William Shakespeare, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for Helen Vendler of Harvard University and poetry critic for The New Yorker. We'll talk about Shakespeare's sonnet on lust with an eye to what Helen Vendler calls reading for difference. Who's the speaker and what prompts the voice we hear? Reading for Difference in the Sonnets of William Shakespeare. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.